Hello, everybody. This is Bill Cameron from The Drive. Podcasts of The Drive are presented by Southeastern Industrial Contractors, now hiring for great-paying, skilled trade positions. Call 334-209-6355 to learn more. Thanks for listening.
Live from Auburn, the sports capital of Alabama, this is The Drive. The Drive with Bill Cameron and Dan Peck on ESPN 106.7 and online at ESPNAU.com. To be a part of The Drive, call 334-321-1390, toll free at 888-382-7502, or email The Drive at ESPNAU.com.
An Auburn Network production.
Live from Auburn, the sports capital of Alabama, this is The Drive. The Drive with Bill Cameron and Dan Peck on ESPN 106.7 and online at ESPNAU.com. To be a part of The Drive, call 334-321-1390, toll free at 888-382-7502, or email The Drive at ESPNAU.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome in to the Thursday edition of The Drive. Hope everybody doing well. Another, man, just gorgeous day. It was a little bit cooler today. Felt a little more fall-ish. So enjoy it, folks, while you can. Welcome in to the Thursday Drive. We've got the regular crew here for a Thursday. It's Bill and Dan, Justin Ferguson from the Auburn Observer, and Drew at the controls. Ferg, how you doing?
Doing all right. Enjoying the off week. I think we all needed it, especially the Auburn football team.
Yeah, I think they probably more than most of
but
us.
But I'm taking advantage of it, though. I'm enjoying it.
Can't help but notice Ferg in the biscuits hat, and you know we did. You talked a little weather there, Bill. Doesn't seem like it was worst case scenario in Florida compared to some of the warnings in the greater Tampa Bay area.
It could have been worse,
but still. Yeah, still a very serious storm passing through the Florida Peninsula last night, and hopefully hopefully things can return to normal for those folks.
It made landfall as a 3 or 2.
3.
Yeah,
I think it weakened to a 2 actually. Yeah, strong 2.
It was right on the border.
And Sarasota.
I had experience earlier this year being on the outskirts of a 5 and knowing what. Barely getting brushed by one of those mets. I can't even imagine what it was like, right there. And the pictures from Tropicana Field are the craziest.
Oh, that's
thing.
Unbelievable. The roof.
Yeah, just gone. It's just gone.
We talked about it yesterday.
I said, gee, I hope it's okay. And it's like, it was built for that.
What they ended up doing was, it was built to, I think the roof was built to sort of break away and not fragment into destructive pieces,
right.
Which was something that happened during the Superdome. I think this was because it's a fiberglass and cloth roof. Now that stadium itself probably, I don't know how much of that was. And I do remember hearing that a lot of the stadium is built to withstand weather in the event of a strong storm. Like the turf and the seats themselves and things like that. Like I aside from drying it out and things, like I wonder how much, how extensive the damage is going to be. They evacuated. They were staging first responders at Tropicana Field earlier this week in anticipation of the recovery. And I think they, as the storm got closer, they decided to move everybody out. And so nobody was actually in the stadium when it happened. But, yeah, the pictures from Tropicana and some of the, some of the damage more inland in Central Florida, it's going to be it's been a rough month or so for that area. As far as enduring extreme weather, but thankfully, some of the warnings you were getting from the National Weather Service earlier this week about what could happen if this storm at full strength was a direct hit on the Tampa Bay area, it sounds like a lot of that didn't necessarily happen.
Well, the purpose of that is to inform everybody and let them know this is what could happen, and much better to be prepared or evacuate then be able to come back.
Yeah.
Than to stick around and actually not be around if you plan on sticking around.
I've seen quite a few Florida tags the last day or so just anecdotally. I would think that maybe some folks evacuating decided the Auburn Opelika area wouldn't be a bad choice. this week.
Janiah Broome's family made it up here.
Janiah Broome's family evacuated from that's Plant. I believe Plant got hit pretty hard. Actually, I was reading about that earlier today. But yeah, it's hopefully everyone is folks will be all right in the aftermath of a very strong. I mean, when counties are suspending emergency operations,
no kidding.
Like when you get that warning, when it's like, hey, 911 will not work.
Yeah.
Like plan accordingly. Well, like when you get that, like it's a very serious situation, and that was going on in a lot of Florida in the last day or so.
No question about it. And so again, thoughts out to anyone who has suffered any from this. I will sort of give a sarcastic shout out to my nephew and his family. You know, the golf ball folks.
Of course, yes.
They had planned
of the Connecticut golf ball folks.
No. The one with the
Putt. Yeah, the inventors.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. Putlink. But then they had been planning for a long time. This was their family trip to Disney World.
I know some other folks who were doing that this
week.
Yeah.
And what did those folks do?
I don't know.
Well.
I think they were supposed to be going this weekend.
Well, so. they were there, and they were going to be there for the full, I think it was like last Saturday through this Sunday.
Mm.
So they got there, and they decided they were going anyway, and they stayed. And they're waiting for the park to reopen and go in. And fortunately for them, I mean, just some rain, and they didn't ever lose power. So,
oh wow,
fortunate for
that's
them.
That's a decent place if you're going to be holed up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a decent place to make it work, I would say. I felt the same way when I was at our resort in Jamaica. Like, if I had to potentially lose power or, like, a place where they're built to take care of other humans is probably
that. Although I do wonder how many of the accoutrements would be available, because you probably don't want the employees on the road either in
no,
those situations.
Sure, no.
So it's like, I would think that maybe... It's yeah.
Even still,
Disney, you're right. A hotel,
Disney and emergency operations has got to be like miles better than what a lot of us have.
You would think, yeah, you would sure think so.
It probably beat Santa Tropicana Field, like between the two possibilities in the last day or so.
Look in Jamaica. I watched someone make eggs in a hallway. Like, and it was some of the best eggs I've ever had in my life. So, like, anything is possible.
They have the full omelet bar in the hallway.
Yes.
We're talking. Okay, well, no,
they were running off of a gas stove that they had wheeled out there.
Oh,
it was crazy.
Cool.
I could survive in a fallout shelter for a while if you told me we had a full omelet bar going. against one of the walls or something.
All right, so it is the Thursday edition of The Drive. We'll talk some sports as well. Even though it's an open week for Auburn football, Auburn basketball, I mean, it's just around the corner. We're a week away from tip-off at Tumors.
Yeah, a week away from tip-off at Tumors. Basketball, taking these next couple days off with the fall break for the university, but been a pretty busy week. I got to talk to Miles Kelly and Tahat Pettiford for the first time this week.
That's good.
Got a interview request for those guys. Wrote about some of that at the Observer. Been at practice most of the week. It's gonna get here quick. And a lot of hype around this program. SEC Media Days next Tuesday in Birmingham, and then yesterday Evan Maya dropped the new preseason ratings. A lot of the computer systems have already dropped out, and he had his rating system had Janiah Broome as the number one player in college basketball heading into the season, which kind of makes sense. He was number three behind Edie and Klingon for most of the year in box plus minus. So, yeah, I mean, it just goes to show you just what Auburn's got at their disposal this season. I also noticed this week at practice they've got the new banners up, got the new SEC tournament title banner up, Janiah's name's on the All-American banner. They've got the NCAA tournament appearance up there as well. So, yeah, like a lot of hype and well deserved for Broome and the rest of this team heading into the season.
Yeah, absolutely. The excitement is through the roof on this. I noticed the university. Let's see, Auburn Athletics sent out a note today that there are a few standing room tickets for some non-conference games. That's it. A week ago, when the standing room tickets went on sale for the conference games, those things were gone within 15 minutes.
Got times to tip off times a day for pretty much everything. There's a couple of flex games, a lot of late games. A lot of night games for Auburn, even some on the weekends.
That's a compliment.
Yeah.
Because that they expect it to be, a game that more people across the country are going to be interested in.
Yeah, and then there's some really, really late tip-offs in some of these spots. But, yeah, I think a lot of night games, like you said.
A lot of 8 o'clock. It seemed like there were a lot of 8 o'clock midweek games.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned
the late window.
You mentioned Evans' rankings, right? And I know Borzello on ESPN.com, Jeff Borzello just did a too early. I think it's going to be his final preseason top 25 before – the games get going. He said he really grappled with Kansas versus Alabama for the number one spot on his list.
That's crazy to me.
He ended up going with Kansas, Bama 2, UConn 3,
and Houston. And he had Houston at 4.
UConn 3, Houston 4, Iowa State 5. He's got Auburn at 10, and I thought the most curious thing, he's moved Auburn up from 11 from his most recent ranking, and he did this the last time too. His projected starting lineup for Auburn includes both Miles and Chad Baker Mazzara, and doesn't include Chaney Johnson. So he's got JP, Denver, Miles, Chad, and Janai as his projected starting five. I'm curious, both of you guys knowing the team pretty well. How often do you think we'll see? I think some of it depends on how Miles fits with the team. Do you think we'll see those five out there together?
Yeah, you've got too many fours, think, for that to be the case.
Well, I just don't see. I don't see Chad being a consistent four.
Yeah, I think you could run it sometimes against certain lineups, but it's kind of like my thing with Janai and Dylan playing at the same time. I think you could do it at times. Right. I don't think it's going to be something that you
I don't think
lean
it's
going to
be the dominant lineup.
No.
I guess
you have several fours on this roster. You've got Chaney Johnson, you've got Turtle Hudson, and you got Chris Moore. All those guys are working at the four, and then you may give Janai some minutes at the four.
Yeah, you've also got, depending on how many minutes, I think Dylan.
Four is like arguably the deepest position on the team.
I think Dylan. How much Dylan is out there, and how much Dylan needs to be out there will sort of that'll influence, and I guess how Janai takes to the four.
Is
the other question there.
You may see it at times. I keep believing that you're going to see Janai Broom the vast majority of his minutes at the five. That's his best spot. That's where he needs to play.
And you're both believers in a better Chaney Johnson second season. Is that?
Yeah, absolutely right. I like the way he finished.
Yeah, he finished really well last season. Him and Dever Jones both had great finishes to the year. The thing with Chaney, I mean. That's my thing that I've been trying to get with Auburn fans this year. Because, like, man, I don't know about Chaney. Look, if Chaney Johnson, if a year or two of Chaney Johnson is your fifth starter, man, you've got a deep and loaded basketball team. He does a lot of stuff that I think really fits well with this offense and defense, honestly. But, like, I think people think that you need to, like, this team needs to have, like, five dudes who are all going to average double figures. Nobody does that, but even still, like, I think Chaney's got some of that breakout potential. There were some games last season where he got into his zone and took over.
My guess would be that it's just tempting to put Miles Kelly in the starting lineup because he averaged 14 points a game last year at Georgia Tech.
I think he could absolutely start over Chad.
Right. Well, and that would be the competition. Would be Miles versus Chad.
You already know Chad Baker-Mazzara can't come off the bench and play well. I think Miles is. Yeah, it just depends on how he fits in. I'm really high on Miles Kelly. I wrote about him earlier this week. I think he could be the missing piece for this offense. And that's the thing about this team that is so intriguing to me is that between Denver, Miles, and Chad, somebody's not going to start. Unless Denver wins the starting point guard job and you just kind of go 2-3 from there, more than likely you are going to bring one of those three guys off the bench. And, like, those are all proven, experienced scorers. And really good basketball players, and like that depth that they're going to have, it's just a completely different world than Auburn was in last year. Where last season, you felt like you were having to fight to get any sort of consistency scoring from your backcourt. You'd have some flashes from Chad. You'd have some flashes from Denver, especially late last season. But for a good stretch of that year, Auburn's guard scoring production was among the lowest in the SEC. And that's something that they have really revamped this year by adding Pegues and Kelly and Todd Pettiford and Shekai Howard, and then, you know, getting what could you get out of year two from Jones and Becker Mazzara.
What's your Pegues comp, seeing him in practice for a couple of – I mean, we've seen him play at Furman too, but, like, does he remind you of – you know, I mean, you don't necessarily have to stick with Auburn either.
Yeah, I mean,
but if there's – like, how does he fit in with this group?
I think he fits in really, really well. He is a very steady hand at point guard. I think he does a really good job of controlling the game. You saw that at Furman, you know, pretty good assist to turnover ratio. I think he is a guy that has some more scoring juice to him than maybe some guys we've seen, like maybe last year. You know, a little bit more assertive with the ball in his hand. I don't know if comp wise that anything just immediately jumps out to me, but like I like his fit with this team a lot. He does a really good job, I think, of managing the offense and running the show. I think right now it's just a matter of learning his teammates more and learning the system more. You know, I had a question for in the mailbag tomorrow that somebody was like, why is it Pegues not the starter yet at the one? Is there something wrong? It's like, well, you know, Bruce Pearl's MO is they let guys compete, you know, pretty much all the way to the start of the year. Remember, this time last year it was, oh, Jalen Williams and Chaney Johnson are in a battle at four. I don't think that hurt Jalen at all that, you know, that he was still in a battle with them, but – I think Pegues, like, at the point guard spot, it may take a little bit more time to kind of assert yourself in there because it's such a big role, and you're learning a new offense, and you're learning new teammates, and you've got so much pressure on you to kind of run the show. It's going to be a lot of fun, though, to watch because I think Pegues is going to give you that, like, steady hand and experience that you were kind of lacking at times at point guard last season. And then on top of that, you do have flexibility with Denver Jones and Tahad Pettiford. Being able to play that spot. And, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is not going to be breaking news to anybody, but, like, I think fans are going to really, really like watching Tahad Pettiford and Shekai Howard play basketball, especially coming off the bench. I think they are going to be energy, full-throttle dudes whenever they get out there, and it could be a lot of fun seeing them on a bench unit where they don't have that pressure to be the guys right away.
Justin Ferguson from the Auburn Observer with us as usual here on the Thursday Drive. You can join us. Give us a call on the Drive hotline, sponsored by Skybar. That number is 334-321-1390.
You can also text the show, 334-564-1840 on the Drive text box, presented by our friends at Southeastern Industrial Contractors. They also sponsor the podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll get to our first break of the afternoon. Come on in and join us here on the Thursday Drive.
This November,
Peck on ESPN 106.7 and online at ESPNAU.com. To be a part of the drive, call 334-321-1390, toll free at 888-382-7502, or email the drive at ESPNAU.com.
Welcome back into the Thursday edition of The Drive. Bill, Dan, Justin Ferguson here in the studio. Love for you to join in. Anything on your mind sports-wise? We were just talking a little baseball there during the break. Got the NLDS waiting for the final participant to make it to the championship series tomorrow after your Dodgers came through big time in that bullpen game. How about a shutout? Bullpen
big
game,
biggest shutout victory in Dodgers playoff history.
Is that right?
They had won a game seven zilch in the past, but no, they'd never beaten anybody by more than that until last night when they're able to keep the Padres off balance with a whole bunch of bullpen guys pitching really well. Kopech is that's my kind of relief pitcher, isn't it? I mean, I mean, that guy is overpowering when he gets it going. It can be out of control too. But I was curious when the Dodgers between Flaherty and Kopech, the Dodgers made a couple of moves that really helped them win the division. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what Dave's going to do. I have not seen an update on if it's Flaherty or Yamamoto tomorrow. I know they're both available, and I wonder if he's going to play that. Until he absolutely has to make a decision, and maybe they'll both be available in case the first one gets into trouble. It's if you're a casual baseball fan or not really much of a baseball fan, tomorrow night is going to feel like a heavyweight title fight. Dodgers Padres winner take all in Dodger Stadium is going to be that. I think that's like a must. That's a must watch baseball playoff game, and we'll see what it looks like. Padres going with Darvish, right?
Yes. I said yesterday, if I were the Padres and I have nothing, they didn't ask me about it, and the Dodgers are going with a bullpen game and I'm up 2-1, instead of throwing Dylan Cease on short rest, I would have gone with the bullpen as well yesterday. Hey, worst case, now in hindsight, worst case scenario, you've got to rest Dylan Cease.
First.
You have a rested Dylan Cease.
First short rest start of Dylan Cease's career.
And it did not go well. Did not go well for him.
And
from the outset.
And you know, it plays into something we've talked about a little bit with Auburn football this year, which is sometimes the really aggressive move strategically can blow up in your face and give your opponent a much better chance to win.
Yeah, if like it works, it's great.
Right.
If it doesn't, it could be disastrous.
I think like Auburn's taken that gamble a couple of times on the field, and it felt like something the Padres tried last night, going with Dylan Cease on short rest, and now they're leaning really heavily on Yu Darvish to pull off something big on the road tomorrow. The American League games are
tonight, with the Tigers and Yankees having chances to advance to the championship.
Is anyone going home tonight? You think somebody?
Yeah, I think somebody. I think
Cleveland goes home.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. Tigers are on a roll.
Yeah,
I've got a feeling KC's going to send this one back to Yankee Stadium. But yeah, I think the Tigers at home, they've got a chance at home to make it to the American League Championship Series.
Making the playoffs in 10 years, after being a seller at the deadline.
Yes. After being given a 1% chance of making the playoffs after the trade deadline.
I think I saw a stat the other day that was like, it was like 33 players in baseball were making more money than the Tigers playoff roster.
Wow.
I believe that the Tigers, I'm sure I'm going to get this, I'm going to butcher this, but they were the only, either they had the fewest starts.
And that's because Javi Baez is hurt. Yeah. But
they had the fewest starts by position players age 30 or more of anyone in baseball this year. It's everyone who plays for them is 29 or younger, which is, you know, one of the reasons they were sort of building for the future.
Yeah, they didn't.
They're a little ahead of schedule.
They didn't do the whole like filling in with like cheap vets. Like I feel like the Marlins do that way too much.
Yes,
where you look up and you're like, they've just got guys playing out there. The Nats do it a little too often. Rockies definitely do it. The Rockies will also give them $100 million.
Well, the Rockies will do it with their own veterans, right? Like they won't.
They'll spend. They'll spend millions on a Chris Bryant to bring him in. He still hasn't played the total of a full season. Is it 3 years now?
What's baseball's worst contract? Rendon, right? But sure.
Baseball's worst contract.
Yeah, right now is. I mean, Bryant's there. I mean,
he's up there.
No, I had. There was a really obvious example of this the other day. Rendon. I think it was Baez because like before he got hurt, it was like Cubs. He was like the worst player in baseball. He was like the worst position player in baseball. Mm-hmm.
The Diamondbacks gave that pitcher. It's looking like trouble.
Jordan Montgomery.
That's looking like early.
I wanted him too.
Early trouble. You can have him.
Yeah.
You make a call.
Yeah, he was out there for everybody at the end of the season.
Yeah. I mean, I thought the Braves were gonna like roll the dice on him, just because you know it felt like you could have used one more veteran. Instead, they make the
Instead, they make
the Chris Sale trade, and he wins the Triple Crown.
So. Diamondbacks have really set things up well for themselves now because. It's obvious that everybody knows that they don't think he's any good, so
yeah.
he's not worth anything in a deal.
No.
Well, they were probably going to have to fix him internally or just pay him to go away.
Going anyway, back to what the Tigers have done, like I don't understand why the Nationals don't do that. Like the Nats will roll into a year with several really good prospects or young guys that are like CJ Abrams.
Let's watch and see what they do this offseason.
But I think they need to do that instead of like giving money to like.
I think they're in the Soto sweepstakes.
Don't they still have
very much? Bring him back.
Don't they still have ownership? Like, isn't there still a question of if that group wants to own them long term? And like for some, a lot of the decisions that the Nationals have made.
I mean, if you could go get a Soto, that's one thing. But like, you don't need to be like paying dudes like Joey Gallo.
I think just go ahead and let kids play there.
That's right.
A lot of the decisions the Nationals have made post-championship seem to have been made with the idea of of running the thing on a much smaller budget and maybe trying to keep costs low for a potential buyer. Like that's what the you know like, the like I so and yeah. I wonder if
like next year they should have like Dylan Cruz. Like it should be a
James Wood, Dylan Cruz,
and Lane Thomas
because yeah. they haven't.
And well, no, Lane Thomas is gone. It's Young, the Florida guy.
Think about who's gone from that. I mean, think about who's left that organization since like what 2015, 2016. Like the only person
since the World Series.
Yeah, the only person they paid was Strasburg, and it was a disaster. Yeah. Although I think they got some of that money back through you know insurance or whatever because it was injury related. But like between Bryce and Trey and Rendon and Soto and
I mean if they could get Soto back after all of this. It would be kind of remarkable because mm-hmm. then you would have an example of a team trading a great young player, knowing that they probably wouldn't be able to pay him down the line, getting a bunch of prospects for it, and then getting back into it when he gets free.
Prospects who have turned into pretty good players.
Yeah. How does Soto? Was there
some Mackenzie Gore,
C.J. Abrams, and James Wood?
Yeah, they're all on that trade.
And they drafted
Padres draft really well.
They drafted the fella from LA. They drafted Cruz too, right?
Cruz.
Yeah, they have Cruz too. I mean, did he come up?
Who's the dude I have? They have another infielder that's really good. I have him on my.
They've got a couple of infielders.
Garcia.
Yeah, because Luis Garcia, I mean, had a really good catcher? Year.
I don't think this is kids come. This is kids not come up yet.
K Bear, Ruiz, their catcher. I mean,
not a bad situation.
Brady House.
Yeah,
a lot of people really like Brady House.
They have some good young talent.
Yeah,
some very. And that's what I said.
Just let those kids play. Like, and I think the Tigers are a good example of like give you know have some growing pains. That makes more sense to me than like rolling out like a lineup next year where you have a bunch of just like below average veterans.
Mm-hmm.
A
lot of the guys we talked about may not have been ready for an opening day role. Like I think there's some belief that like if you want the you know and not even for service time reasons because they've largely changed. Although some teams do play service time games with their rookies too, where
less
it's like,
fewer and fewer teams do.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, you get too many advantages now if you don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Did we mention the Tennessee third baseman? Because he's a Nationals prospect too, right?
Trey Lipscomb.
Yeah, Lipscomb's still probably in this conversation. You know, that's a guy who played a lot in this season. So yeah, you're right. That's a team with a bunch of yeah. Bill, how would Soto leaving play in New York? That feels like I've assumed that's where he's.
If they win a pennant, I think it'll be you'll be all
I think,
right.
I think both New York teams are going to be in the Soto.
I think he ends up with the Mets. That's my prediction.
Because I don't think the polar bear. I think polar bear is going to be elsewhere.
Yeah,
and they will use
this would
that
be
money
so. Out.
Maybe I'm watching too many Seinfeld reruns. George would sign that guy. No way.
I think they're going to try. I think they're yeah, really going to try.
No way George would let that.
But
guy
I mean,
leave.
Like,
if
but
I, yeah, if I were in charge of the Yankee money, I would not let him go.
No,
I wouldn't let him go.
What are you
but
doing?
They're talking like 14 years, like $550 million for him, which. Pay it if you can, but like when I see a contract like that, I just immediately think of Steve Cohen. Like I think the Mets will do that.
If you
more
don't
than
want
the Yankees
to,
will.
Like I when the Yankees lost the bidding for Robinson Cano, like that was a guy they kind of wanted, but there was another team willing to pay him like a megastar. That's one thing. But if you're the Yankees and you're in the bidding for someone you want,
like this that you they've had, already, and they've that already had a, that and, has had his best year of his career,
and they've already
year?
Paid Judge.
Yes.
So like it's not like they're having to wait.
If Soto's willing to come back and you're the Yankees, you better bring him back, man, or people are going to, you know, or you're not I mean, it ain't the Steinbrenners I remember.
No, the fans will let him know too. Yeah, you're not kidding. One other quick note. I mean, we were talking about this during the break, just a couple of days after we hear Brian Snitker say there won't be any changes in the Braves coaching staff, there are three changes.
Yeah, Seitz are being fired, the assistant hitting coach as well being fired. Not surprising to me. Even with all the injuries the Braves had this year, they were just worse at the plate. Like they were not as good hitting the ball. Period.
No, you're right.
They had one of the worst OPSs on I think it was OPSs on balls that were like strikes, like balls in the zone. They were one of the worst hitting teams in baseball, which was weird. So yeah, he needed to change things up there. Sal Fasano, I'm gonna miss him. He says
they're not even gonna replace that spot,
which kind of sucks. I do think they need to change some things up. You know, I'm not the biggest Brian Snitker fan in the world. I don't like the way he manages bullpens and stuff like that. But you know, dude want a title and he's a lifer with the organization. You let him go out on his terms. I think that's the smart way to do it. But yeah, shaking some things up will be interesting. Obviously, you don't need to do anything with your pitching coach because he missed half the year, and the Braves still have the best ERA in baseball. So I'm very interested to see what the Braves do upcoming. I do think there's going to be a tendency to just say, hey, this past year was a lot of bad injury luck, and just roll the dice, you know, you just try to run it back moving forward. I do think, though, they are talking like they might spend a little more, and they can. They're already a luxury tax team. And the funny thing about this team this year is, like, unless you go try to get Juan Soto, which would be very out of the Braves.
Yeah, they could use him.
You could use him, but unless they go do that.
You've got a player in mind.
There's a limit.
I know who you want.
There's a clear player I have in mind for Atlanta here. But I'm afraid that he's going to be a Dodger when it's all said and done.
You always have to be concerned.
Well, I think the Arcia thing fell off really quickly the last year and a half, and I feel like you need another shortstop, and you don't really have one coming up in your system. So I think they can make it work in the outfield more. They can manage stuff in the outfield more. But if I had one wish, it would be Willy Adames as a Brave next season, and you put him in that lineup. That's my ultimate. Yeah, that's my ultimate fantasy this year for the Braves. I think you can be fine. Like, I think they can. I think their pitching staff's fine. I think they're going to bring back a lot of that bullpen. I like pretty much everywhere else they go. I think the end of the season showed that you could figure out, a Kelnick Laureano platoon in left field would work. I hope Ronnie's okay to play full time in right field when he comes back. But yeah, I mean they'll be in a really good spot. Trade Soler for some prospects or something, or just maybe another guy you can pick up. But I do think they're going to be a good spot.
Want to mention baseball tonight? We will have on ESPN 106.7. We're going to have the Yankees Royals game. Yankees could be going to the ALCS. Hard to believe, Justin. I mentioned it yesterday. 2010's the only decade of like Major League Baseball with like the Yankees in it where they didn't go to a World Series. So it's like it's been 15 years since the last Yankees championship. They're on the verge of – they got to knock off the Royals, but got to knock off the fighting Adam Coles tonight. You can catch that on ESPN 106.7. We will also have Dodgers-Padres tomorrow night, and we will have LSU Ole Miss on ESPN 106.7 on Saturday night.
Yeah, and we will talk some football when we come back. Love for you to join in, 334-321-1390, as we continue with the Thursday Drive. From the Auburn Observer, Drew at the controls, and yes, we'd love for you to join in. Anything you want to talk about, some really interesting games around the country, especially in the SEC once again this week. Auburn with the week off, very deserved open date. I'd say two-thirds of the team teams in the SEC have had their open date. Auburn, one of the last teams to have an open date. Auburn, Arkansas, and Texas A&M, all with this weekend off. One of those teams that has not had an open date, we were just talking about them. You mentioned that we have that LSU Ole Miss game on Saturday night down in Baton Rouge. Ole Miss is playing for the seventh straight week this week, and I believe they are the only team in the SEC. Yes, they are. The only team in the SEC that has to play seven straight weeks without a break.
It's rare. I mean, looking around college football, it's rare to find a team that's played six games to this point in the season. Most teams are, you know, most teams have a record, with five games total. So yeah, Ole Miss is
it's also a season with two open dates. For everybody in college.
Yeah, I mean this is it's been Ole Miss's faced, aside from the Kentucky game. You know,
it hadn't been a gauntlet of. They've terribly tough teams.
They've faced little resistance in a lot of these games, but still, this is a different kind of challenge than they faced all season, Bill. They're going to Baton Rouge at night, and we were just saying, LSU and Clemson strike me as two teams, because they lost opening day, people have decided, well, you can just put them on the back burner.
This isn't the way it used to be. The 12-team playoff, you can't just forget about a team that loses a game early on.
And just like we were saying about Dodgers Padres on Friday night, that is a winner take all. That is an elimination game. The loser season is over. LSU Ole Miss,
it's close.
It's going to be extremely difficult for the loser of that game to make the playoff. Like, you look at what they both have left. You look at sort of the realities of their schedule. You know, if LSU beats Ole Miss, it turns the Georgia game into a must-win game for Ole Miss if they want to make the college football playoff. Absolutely. So maybe not impossible, but those kind of those kind of odds.
But they've got Georgia, the game, that trip to Arkansas sandwiched in between Oklahoma and Georgia at home, that's going to be really, really tough. And that's what they have after the open date.
Kind of feel like for LSU, if they were to drop the Ole Miss game, it turns the Alabama game
into
a game they would have to make the college football playoff. Because I do wonder, a 10-2 LSU team that only lost to USC and Alabama has a pretty good shot of making the college football playoff.
It does.
Especially if they won in Oxford. Not in Oxford. Especially if they beat this Ole Miss team on Saturday night, and they get to put that win in the cap.
Yeah, and then you're looking at Alabama. Now that Alabama lost to Vandy, they've got a trip to Knoxville.
Yes, they do.
Before they go to Baton Rouge. So, I mean, it because of who some of these teams lost to, Alabama losing to Vandy, Ole Miss losing to Kentucky, who's the other one? Missouri losing, but Missouri got blown out. Who was the other shocking loss that we've had in the SEC? Oh, Tennessee losing to Arkansas.
Right.
Although Arkansas is a little better than those other teams. But that means in one of these normal big rivalry type games, Alabama, Tennessee, LSU, Alabama, the loser there is likely to have three losses, and that might knock them out of the playoff picture.
Yeah, tough to imagine a scenario. I know we talked to Pascal a little bit about that. David Pascal, who I believe is going to join us.
Yes, he will. He'll join us in about 20 minutes.
Yeah, top of the hour. But I mean, it's tough. I'm curious to see if when we get our playoff picture, if there's a 9-3 team that can really make an argument that they should be included as an at-large because of their body of work, despite a 9-3 record. I imagine that team would come from the SEC if it happened, and it would, you would need. But the way I see it right now, like I don't know if a 9-3 team is going to have a strong enough argument.
Well, like, especially if it's a team like Ole Miss, like we're talking about, if LSU were to beat them Saturday night and they lose to Georgia, I don't see any way, because who's their marquee victory over?
The 9-3, to
their
me,
biggest
the,
win would be maybe Oklahoma.
Pascal's thing has been the 9-3 team with the best shot is Georgia, because
who they play.
Because I think because of the respect they have in general, and then because of they would 9-3 means they went 1-3 against Alabama, Texas, Ole Miss, and Tennessee,
and they already beat Clemson too.
That's
another team that, as you said a while ago when you were talking about LSU, that's a team that is playing a whole lot better now.
Yeah, I know Miami is ahead of Clemson in the polls. If you ask me right now who's been the most impressive ACC team this season, with all due respect to undefeated Miami and undefeated Pitt, 5-0 Pitt Panthers as well, watch out. But I would still say Clemson has probably been your most impressive ACC team so far, and Georgia holds that victory over the Clemson Tigers. So, I mean, feels like it would maybe be Georgia who could possibly do it.
Georgia's other thing is none of those teams did they play in Athens. They played all four of those teams, Clemson, Georgia, Texas, and Alabama, away from Athens.
Yeah, the Ole Miss, Texas, and Alabama games are road games. The Clemson game was neutral, and the Tennessee game would be in Athens. But still, like I think that's where the notion that Georgia has a schedule daunting enough to justify justify possible inclusion there. We'll see. But nevertheless, and Justin, this sort of is how we got started on this point, that LSU Ole Miss on Saturday night feels like a game where the loser is in a real. I mean, they have a gauntlet to run to make the college football playoff. And those are two good teams that are probably. Those are two college football. Seemingly, those are two college football playoff quality teams, especially in this expanded format.
Right now.
We'll see. LSU probably needs to beat a really good team before you start talking about them.
Ole Miss needs to beat anybody who's decent.
Ole Miss needs to beat somebody with a pulse. You're right. It's at the moment. So the winner gets you know, the winner gets to feel a little bit better about their position in the picture right now, and the loser has the loser's got real work to do. It's an early, really high stakes game in conference play.
Yeah, absolutely. I think two losses doesn't immediately disqualify you, but if you have two losses to teams that aren't necessarily like going to be in the playoff as well,
and
gets tougher to get in.
And Ole Miss has one of those. That's what we were talking about. You've got so many teams that have lost to teams nobody saw them losing to.
Yeah.
Alabama losing to Vandy. Tennessee losing to Arkansas. Ole Miss losing to Kentucky. And no disrespect to those teams that beat them,
sure,
but they're not going to be in the playoffs.
Sure, yeah. And I mean, I think like you look at, you know, LSU, you're like, oh, we lost to USC. Well, USC just lost to Minnesota. Well,
don't look now, but USC might catch loss number three this weekend with Penn State coming to town. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a loss that's increasingly, like, it's not as, I mean, and you wonder how important it'll be in a beauty pageant at the end of the season if LSU lost to 6-6 USC instead of 10-2 USC or something like that. I imagine beating a team like that's probably really helpful, especially if they win games. We were just talking about Georgia's victory over Clemson. Like, that could be, if Georgia's lobbying as a 9-3 or 10-2 team that they belong in the college football playoff this year, the fact that they beat Clemson away from home is going to be something that I think helps sway the argument.
All right, we'll get to our final break of hour number one. Brian, hang on. You're up when we come back here on the Thursday Drive.
Big Eating in Auburn
and online at ESPNAU.com. To be a part of the drive, call 334-321-1390. Toll free at 888-382-7502 or email the drive at ESPNAU.com.
Final segment of hour number one here on the Thursday Drive. Let's get to the drive hotline. And Brian is up first. Hey, Brian.
Hey, what's up, guys? How are y'all?
We're doing fine.
How you doing, bud?
That's good. Hey, listen, I hate to change the subject on y'all. I've only got about 10 minutes left in my drive today, but let me ask y'all this. You know, and I don't want to overlook the upcoming season. I think it's going to be a special one for Auburn, but with as much as Bruce has to replace after this year, do any of the three of y'all get the impression that he may be thinking about hanging it up after this year, or do you think he has a few more years left in it?
That's an interesting question. I think a lot of it may depend on what Auburn does this season. You know, but yeah, I mean, it's whatever happens. Yeah, you're going to have to. I mean, you may return only like two guys next season. So it is going to be a tough one.
I hope you didn't force some drivers off the road with that question, Brian.
Yeah, I get yelled at whenever we speculate on the end of Bruce's tenure at Auburn. So I'm going to say no, I don't think. Like I think he plans on coaching.
I think he could.
Yeah.
Coach for a long time.
I definitely think he could.
And I think they continue to build for the future. But yes, I mean
it's going to be a major rebuild after this year.
It is, and that's what led me to that question. But let me ask this also in part of that. You know, I've heard debate back and forth about, hey, who replaces Bruce when he does ultimately leave. And I've heard some people say there's no way Steven can replace him. He doesn't have head coaching experience. And, you know, I laugh at that because I look at the hires that SEC schools make now, and these schools are not hiring proven, on the whole, they're not hiring proven known commodities that have won at a high level. They're hiring guys from smaller schools who have won at those smaller schools, but they haven't proven it in the conference. I mean, you look at who LSU hired a couple years ago. Look who Alabama hired a couple years ago. Who Kentucky just hired. And I know that's a different circumstance, but you get my point. To me, it's a natural transition to Steven if Bruce does leave in the next few years. I don't know how y'all feel about that.
I will say that I think we have seen enough from some really good programs of turning it over in-house that I think it could work. Auburn's going to play one of those teams this season in Duke. You know, how do you replace K? Well, you give it to his top assistant and a guy who had been there. North Carolina, how do you replace Roy Williams? Well, Hubert Davis is on the bench. I'm like, I think it has worked enough, you know, at some of these big programs that, like, yeah, like Auburn isn't North Carolina or Duke, but what Auburn is in a situation where it's like, I can see why you'd want to keep it going. Right, you know, mm-hmm. if I have the success that Duke and North Carolina have had, I want to keep that going. Let's keep it in-house and roll it. And I think Auburn, in a similar vein, is going to look at themselves and say, hey, why don't we just keep this kind of rolling? If of course, whenever Bruce Pearl hangs it up, Auburn is still a championship-contending program at the top of its game. So I do think there's some validity in that.
John Shire is probably the comparison, the most mod, like the yeah. comparison I think that would be most similar to Bruce Pearl turning it over to Stephen. John Shire had only worked at Duke as yeah. an assistant after playing for Coach K. Was there from 14 to 22, got the job at the age of 35. I think when Duke handed the job over from Coach K to him. So I mean that would be the most recent example I think of a yeah. of a coach of a program like that turning the keys over to someone with a somewhat limited resume and no head coaching experience and no coaching experience really. I mean I know Bruce is it's a different sort of deal. I see both sides of it. Like, I could understand why Auburn would want to keep the program in the hands of somebody with experience, with head coaching experience at the major conference level. I do take a little excitement.
I think it's going to be so hard to find a guy like that, though, to the point right here. I mean, you look at a lot of these programs, it's guys, they are hiring guys that are mid-majors and smaller conference programs. I mean, even once it really, really worked, I mean, Where was Dan Hurley before he was at UConn? Where was Nate Oates before he was at Alabama? Like, yeah, I mean, I think you're more likely to do that than poach somebody up top because you're Auburn. You know, it's a tougher spot to be in, and I don't think that happens nearly as much in college basketball.
Appreciate the call, Brian. It's a very interesting question. All right, we are halfway done. Come to the top of the hour. Got another hour to go, though. David Pascal from Chattanooga joins us on the other side. So stick with us here on the Thursday Drive.
Live from Auburn, the sports capital of Alabama, this is The Drive. The Drive with Bill Cameron and Dan Peck on ESPN 106.7 and online at ESPNAU.com. To be a part of The Drive, call 334-321-1390, toll free at 888-382-7502, or email The Drive at ESPNAU.com.
Welcome into hour number two of the Thursday Drive. Bill, Dan, Justin Ferguson from the Auburn Observer here in the studio, and the second hour of the show brought to you by the good folks at the Orthopedic Clinic, East Alabama's go-to center for orthopedic care, with locations in Auburn and Opelika, on the web at orthoclinic.com. We're going to get to the Drive hotline, sponsored by Skybar, that number 334-321-1390.
You can also text the show, 334-564-1840 on the Drive text box. That's presented by our friends at Southeastern Industrial Contractors. They also sponsor the podcast, available however you get your podcasts.
Yes, so we'll get a call because Brett was on, called in just before the end of hour number one. So we'll talk with Brett, and then we will get to David Pascal. But let's go ahead and get to the Drive hotline. And Brett is up first this hour. Hey, Brett.
Hey, guys. Dan, tell me what you think about the all bullpen approach.
Ooh, I mean, guy after guy coming up huge, right? The guy I was, you know, even yesterday, I didn't want to seem overconfident, Brett, but I was nervous about. I was skeptical of Cease on short rest. That was a very aggressive move by the Padres. Yeah. I know they would have had to go to a bullpen game too, but as Bill was advocating for, you go with a bullpen game last night if you're the Padres. And you've got Cease. And
worst case scenario is you're still tied, but you've got Cease on full rest as well as Darvish.
Yeah, so I think it's we'll see what the Dodgers do. I have this feeling it's Yamamoto tomorrow. We'll see what Dave decides to do. But it's it's going back to Dodger Stadium, and I think that place will be a blue hornet's nest tomorrow night for the elimination game.
Yeah, I saw where the Dodgers hadn't released who they're going to pitch. Yeah, I was kind of wondering who it would be also.
I think it was expected to be Flaherty when people were getting ready for, you know, when they were talking about the bullpen game in game four. I think the belief was that Flaherty could get the start. I think both Flaherty and Yamamoto will be ready. I wouldn't be all that shocked to see both of them, especially with the bullpen being used the way it was in game four. But I think they might want Yamamoto to have sort of the boost of the crowd. He's familiar with Darvish from their time, from his time in Japan. So I think it's I think that could be, you know, I think Yamamoto could rise to the occasion in a really big spot in his first year with the team.
Yeah, it doesn't really sound like Freeman's gonna be able to really go either.
No, it's huge to have some utility guys you can lean on, and Muncy being able to play first base is big because it opens up some flexibility elsewhere on the roster. They mentioned it last night. Muncy busted his elbow up really badly playing first base a couple of years ago, last game of the season, and I would just think getting past that and picking up the first base glove again has got to be got to be tough. But he's been Max Muncy.
Yeah, no doubt. Last thing, I did notice this year. Obviously, last game the Dodgers didn't do well versus Darvish, but there was a game this year they faced him, and I think they either got three runs in four innings or four and five or something like that. So hopefully, this is another one of those games.
And he's had an uneven playoff history, is how I would describe. He's had some big moments.
He had an awful one for the Dodgers,
had a disastrous couple of games in a Dodgers uniform that postseason a couple of years ago.
All right, Dan, pull us through.
Appreciate it, Brett. We'll talk. We'll talk Monday.
Good hearing from you, Brett. All right, we will get back now to the Drive Hotline, sponsored by Skybar. Welcome in Our good friend from the Chattanooga Times Free Press and Sport Talk on WGOW. Just got done with his show less than 10 minutes ago up there in Chattanooga, and that is David Pascal. Hey, David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I was enjoying listening to that Dodger talk. That bullpen game was a thing of beauty last night.
Oh, when you hear bullpen game, I thought San Diego had all the momentum in the series. I was a little skeptical about Dylan Cease on short rest, but yeah, the Dodgers now going home and feeling very confident after the way they played.
Yeah, that the Padres have been just a thorn. At one point, the Dodgers were 3-8 against them until they won the last two, and then of course this one's 2-2. But yeah, I'd love for the Dodgers to keep advancing. It's weird being a Dodgers fan in Braves territory, but I lived in Los Angeles in Fullerton when I was little, so the Los Angeles teams have always been my favorite.
And Dan, of course, went to grad school out in L.A., so at UCLA, so he's definitely a Dodger guy, too.
I will not be taking any questions about the Bruins football season. However, it's we're working things through. Although, you know, speaking of you know what? And I know we usually talk SEC. I want to talk Auburn, Georgia. I want to talk about where David was this past weekend, right? But that Oregon Ohio State game is like, that thing is just a top five matchup like this during all the things going on this weekend. Like, that is just a giant game.
Big Ten games this weekend out on the coast.
Former Oregon head coach Chip Kelly calling plays now for the Ohio State Buckeyes against his former team, David.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people know that Ohio State's very good. I just don't know how many people. Football fans around here, especially that like to watch the SEC, I don't know how many have actually watched Ohio State games from start to finish, and it's wild because, I mean, chances are there are a lot of SEC fans that watched Alabama, Georgia, and got to see, you know, what Ryan Williams is all about, and if you watch Ohio State, you'll get to watch Jeremiah Smith, two completely different receiver bodies, but two top 10 national prospects that are just already delivering, and you think about just what a fantastic receiver class that was nationally, and Auburn certainly got its share of those guys. But I mean, Jeremiah Smith is something to behold.
Yeah, this college football season has been great. I mean, because there's so many shockers every single week. And man, last week, going into the weekend, it didn't seem like there were that many really exciting ball games. And you look up and nearly half the top 10 goes down, including a couple of big shockers in the SEC. Obviously, the biggest one was Vandy in what was not a fluke, beating Alabama the way they did, controlling the clock for 42 minutes.
Yeah, now you've got Diego Pavia, who's won at Alabama. I mean, one over Alabama and one over Auburn. It's I mean, it just shows you what a dangerous quarterback can do for an offense and for a roster in general. And you're right. I mean, there were certainly some intangibles. I mean, I'm like everybody else. I liked Bama. I didn't like Bama big in that game because of just coming off the emotional win over Georgia, but. You know, wow, what a huge, and of course, Clark Lee, so emotional in the post game, having played at Vanderbilt. You know, every team that Clark Lee played on went 2-10. And you know, that had to be just an overwhelming moment for, like, you just coached the biggest win in Vanderbilt history, and it's all just coming down on you in the news conference, and you could just tell he was fighting back a lot of emotion.
Yeah, unbelievable. It really was watching that. I believe.
Well, one of the cool things about seeing Clark Lee pick up a win like that, too, is like if you talk to going to media days, you get this privilege. If you talk to the Vanderbilt coach, you talk to players, like they're not a punchline. Like, and sometimes, you know, it kind of bothers me when people submit the joke vote for Vanderbilt, you know, at SEC media days to win the title, like, because, like, they, you know, they want to be taken seriously like the rest of the teams in this league, and a win like that, I mean, it just means, it's got to mean the world to them to be able to score, you know, a victory like that for that program.
You know, when you think about the Auburns and the Georgias and the LSUs and the Floridas, I mean, they've had their successes against Alabama, but you think about Vanderbilt. I mean, I'm 57 years old, and the last time Vandy beat Alabama before Saturday, I was a senior at high school. And you think about, like, a Kentucky against Alabama. Kentucky's wins over Alabama came in 1922 and 1997. That's it.
Right.
I mean, yeah, and so you absolutely have to savor those moments because they're so few and far between. And I mean, just the raw reaction around the league. I mean, Kirby Smart, after the Auburn game, waited until that game was over before he walked out and addressed the media. And if you've seen the clip of Lane Kiffin after they won at South Carolina, I mean, he's staring up at the TV the entire time, and the last question was about, you know, how's your team health-wise going to LSU? And he's like, how many timeouts does Bama have left? I mean, he's just totally fixated on the Bama game.
Hey, David, I said earlier this week on our podcast that it wasn't like, I'm not, like, completely blown away that Alabama lost to Vanderbilt. We've seen really good powerhouse teams lose to Vanderbilt before, especially early on in coaches' tenures. I think of Georgia. I think of Auburn's loss there before and all that. But for it to be Alabama, the way that it happened, I think, is the stunning thing to me, because we've seen Vandy pull off upsets in these ugly, low-scoring games. They scored more than 40 points on Alabama. And, like, like you said, not only do they control the clock, they hit big plays when they absolutely had to. That's the thing I think stands out to me the most about this upset, is that, like, not only, like, this was a Vandy upset, but this was nothing like any Vandy upset we've seen, because they've got some dudes on offense starting with Pavia.
And, you know, what about the angle, Justin, of just Alabama losing their you-know-what? I mean, yeah. Malachi Moore, and he wasn't the only one. I mean, you see the footage of all the – And I get it. I mean, you know, I was in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and there was a scene of fans storming the field, and Omari Thomas, a Tennessee defensive tackle, got upset and pushed an Arkansas fan. That happens. But even in just those last couple of minutes, watching Alabama come so unglued was just something that you just – that was a weird image to me, too, because that's just something you don't see a lot of.
Oh, you're right. And now you have, you know, three of the teams in this league – that were expected to be unbeaten at this point have lost to teams that nobody had expected. You know, Alabama to Vandy. You mentioned you were there in Fayetteville last week. This Arkansas team is pretty good.
Well, and again, it goes back to, you know, Diego Pavia at Vanderbilt instantly makes them better. You know, I don't know how much you got to see of KJ Jefferson against Florida, but he just really, really struggled.
Mm-hmm.
And this Talen Green that they got from Boise State did some really nice things. I mean, I thought he had been good up until Saturday night. You know, I think he had like 5 touchdowns, 5 interceptions, so his passing numbers weren't great. But no, I mean, he hit a lot of big throws. And, of course, the big story of that game that I covered was just how lost Tennessee's offensive line looked. And, you know, and Arkansas played a 3-2-6 alignment, wasn't going to let anything over the top of their defense. I think that frustrated Iamaliava with the underneath stuff. And, you know, the crowd, Tennessee had done such a good job of getting up on Oklahoma. But with Arkansas, and we talked about it last week, even though Arkansas, that stadium seats like 15,000 less than Oklahoma, the way it's configured, it's louder. I just don't think Oklahoma's built to be that loud. But, you know, Tennessee had a lot of pre-snap penalties. So, you know, that Tennessee's offensive line gave up 4 sacks and committed 5 penalties. So they just had a disaster. And the other thing that was kind of new, and don't get me wrong, the secondary was supposed to be Tennessee's, you know, question mark going into this season. They had done well through 4 games, but to see Arkansas receivers running free like they did was kind of unique. You had not seen that all year. So Tennessee's got a, you know, whole bunch of questions they've had to address this week.
Well, you've got quite a few teams now, and Ole Miss was the other team I was talking about, losing to one that we didn't expect to see when Kentucky beat them a couple of weeks ago. You've got teams now that the ball games that are coming up, the what we had already preseason perceived as big game matchups are even bigger because it's going to be the second loss for some of these teams. Let's start with, I mean, even though it's a night game, Baton Rouge, Ole Miss and LSU, the loser here may be in trouble, even though with 12 teams, 2 losses isn't going to eliminate you, but you look at a second loss at this point of the season with who both of them have left on the schedule, that could be really tough.
I totally agree. I honestly feel, Bill, that this is like the first elimination game in SEC history. I mean, this feels like it. And you're right in what you said. I don't think either one of these teams is done with a loss, but if you look at their schedule the rest of the way, I do think both of these teams have a third loss coming.
Great.
And then you would be officially out. So, because I don't think I think Georgia may be the only team that can get in, and we've talked about this. I think Georgia may be the only team in the SEC that can get in at 9-3, just because of who they've lost to. And, you know, if they lose at Texas and then lose at Ole Miss, that would also mean that they have a win over Tennessee and a win over Clemson. So I think Georgia at 9-3 is the only team that can do that for sure. There may be another one down the road that sneaks in if just chaos happens everywhere, but I don't think Ole Miss and LSU are teams that can get in at 9-3. So this one really feels like an elimination game. It's in Baton Rouge, but, you know, it's tough. I just feel like Ole Miss is the better team. I mean, you know, the Kentucky game did happen. It was kind of one of those everything that could go wrong did, as far as, you know, Kentucky hitting plays and going for things they typically don't go for on 4th and 7. But, you know, I just like Ole Miss's roster a little bit better, and I think they eke out a close one. Now, you know, if Ole Miss does lose this game, my goodness, that is, you've got some folks saying this is a disappointing situation given what the prospects of what this could have been.
And you've still got Georgia on the schedule if you're Ole Miss and you drop this one. I would think Alabama would have a shot at 9-3, depending on what the 3 losses look like, because they still have, I think Bama's got 4 games against teams that are currently in the top 25, and 3 of those games are away from Tuscaloosa. Bama at Tennessee, at LSU, and at Oklahoma, still to play. So I wonder if Alabama, and beating Georgia certainly would help, although people will point out that game was in Tuscaloosa. They'd probably get more credit there if that game were in Athens. I do think South Carolina's in a world of trouble this weekend. I've had doubts about the South Carolina offense.
Their passing game.
Yeah, I mean, I watched the Old Dominion game, and it feels like it's an adventure every time they pass the ball with Sellers, and it doesn't seem like it gets any better when Ashford is in the game. And I just wonder, you know, I wonder how they're going to get first downs, and especially if Bama can get some points early, what that thing could end up looking like, David.
And Dan, this is where college football is becoming a lot like college basketball. When you, the teams that you lose to and the teams that you, especially in the non-conference, you kind of need those teams to have really good seasons. You want, you know, because it's all on the RPI and all that stuff, and you want the ratings to be strong. So when you're talking about an Alabama team being 9-3, and do they get in and do they get out? I mean, they have to root for Vanderbilt to be, like, pretty good the rest of the way. You don't want a loss to a 4-8 team on your resume, because that could dismiss you. So it becomes a lot like college basketball in that sense. Yeah, you got to think they regroup against South Carolina. I do kind of wonder what the atmosphere is going to be like early game, coming off a stunning loss. But, I mean, I think it should be – I'm like you. South Carolina struggles to score tons of points. They do have a nice defense, so I think it could be kind of one of those ugly 33-13 kind of games.
We were talking about it a little bit yesterday, David. I don't see a lot more – I don't see many more victories left on the South Carolina schedule this year. And I wonder if Beamer's feeling the heat.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one. You know, we've seen it. I mean, all it takes now is one bad year. I mean, the first one that kind of went through that was David Cutcliffe, because, I mean, Eli's senior year, they went 10-3. The next year they went 4-7, and he was not given an extra year. He had winning records up until then, but going from 10-3 to 4-7 was enough.
Tuberville.
Beamer had the backtracking year last year, so it may be. I mean, that's one of those where you certainly didn't hear that mentioned after the win up in Lexington. But, yeah, if the losses keep piling, he may be – and he's one of those in press conferences that may just talk too much and say something that he shouldn't.
Yeah, well, I mean, their schedule, their next three games at Alabama, I mean, they've got – they're in Tuscaloosa tomorrow. They're in Norman next week. And then they've got Texas A&M at home after their open date. I mean, that's a tough three. That's about as tough a four-game stretch with Ole Miss at Alabama, at Oklahoma, and Texas A&M as you're going to find.
Yeah, and that's where, I mean, when you're talking about a 16-team league and just these schedules, it really does. I mean, somebody has to be a 4-8 team that may not be 4-8 bad. Or 5-7 and 5-7 bad kind of thing, but it's just the nature of the beast. It's gonna be how it happens.
All right, Oklahoma beat Texas last year. Texas a solid favorite in this one. I don't know that Oklahoma's got enough offense to keep up in this one.
I'm the same way. I mean, Oklahoma starting a true freshman quarterback for the first time, and of course I know that he won down at Auburn and played well late against Tennessee, but I think this is a different kind of beast. And of course, Sarkisian named Ewers as the starter today for Texas. So certainly Texas, whether it was Ewers or Manning, would have a significant advantage in this game. This is one of those things that is kind of quirky. I mean, Oklahoma has won 6 of the last 7, and the best team doesn't always win this game. But I just think Texas across the board is significantly better. I mean, they're a team that's challenging for a national championship, and Oklahoma is still trying to rebuild to get back to where they were. So I think I picked this one in the paper today, like 38-19, hook 'em.
Yeah.
I think Sark's going to hear about it. You blow this one. It feels like an opportunity to show that you're considerably better than Oklahoma, especially with the true freshman quarterback and the receiver troubles that they're having in the Sooner locker room. I mean, maybe the Oklahoma defense is good, and maybe they can. You know, we were talking about it yesterday. It feels like it would take a situation where the winning team has 17 or 20 for this one to lean Oklahoma, and I just don't think the Texas offense is going to be slowed down like that.
I totally agree. I think if it's low scoring, obviously Oklahoma's got a much better shot.
And when you were talking about Alabama, South Carolina, I get a lot of the same feelings of the Tennessee-Florida matchup in Knoxville.
I don't know what to think about that, Bill. I mean, you know, it's one of those things that Tennessee, there are just so many more questions now, and this is just it's an interesting rivalry, and interesting is a nice way to put it on the Tennessee side, because they're 2-17 in the last 19 meetings against Florida. Florida has steadily gotten better. It's a unique dynamic at quarterback. I mean, you're talking about a veteran in Graham Mertz who had a nice game against Tennessee last year, and then you've got the 5-star freshman in DJ Lagway. They've kind of gone Mertz for 2 series, Lagway for 1, Mertz for 2, Lagway for 1. It's interesting. Florida's offense is kind of starting to come together a little bit. They've been very accurate with the ball. Florida's defense, though, they looked a lot better against UCF. I just don't think UCF's that great. But we all saw Florida against Miami, and we saw them against Texas A&M, and they couldn't stop either one of those teams. And so that's where Tennessee just really has to do its thing. You know, can that offense get back on track? Because really, if you go back to halftime of Oklahoma when Tennessee led 19-3, you know, Tennessee's been outscored 31-20 in the last six quarters. They have not looked good. So this is definitely a key game. I mean, it's a long-time rival anyway. I say long time since the SEC went to divisions in 92. I mean, that was the matchup of the 90s was Tennessee-Florida. But this is such a huge game if Tennessee wants to stay in that playoff picture. And I don't mean just like staying in it and winning 24-22. I mean, this is a game Tennessee needs to – it's a 15-point spread. I'm not sure if Tennessee covers that. But it's one of those that they could certainly send a message that they're back on track by covering.
Those last few drives against Arkansas was the first time this season that Nico has looked inexperienced for an extended period of time, and the accuracy, you know, was a problem, you know, in the second half for Tennessee. You know, I think you know, especially compared to what Tennessee has seen a quarterback at times under Heupel. I thought he seemed like, and maybe he was just dejected after the loss, I thought he was leaving the field pretty gingerly, took a big hit on that final play of the game. Is there any concern about Nico's health?
You know, I think it would be what's upstairs. I mean, you've been sacked seven times in the last two games, and to your point, Dan, most of them have been really hard hits. And you can sit in a press, because I asked him about it after the game, and you can say publicly, no, those sacks don't bother me, I move on to the next play. Well, if you go back and look at those last couple of drives, he had Dylan Sampson on a wheel route all alone on one of those last plays and just never saw him. And so there have been some, I think the offensive line has led to some of Nico's, you know, concerns, because yes, the other day was his not only his first loss as a starter, it was by far his most inaccurate game. And you know, you have that just boneheaded play at the end where he'd be better off to turn around throw it behind his head, yes. You know, and just give somebody in the end zone a chance to catch it instead of running it.
Yeah, that really, that was just unbelievable to see that for an ending. And then there's Kentucky Vandy. We wouldn't even normally mention this ball game. I'm really intrigued with this. How does Vandy handle that win last week? Kentucky is coming off a big win, but they had an open date. Got to feel like it's going to be tough for Vandy to get their heads out of the clouds. But I don't know. I think it could still be a fun game.
Yeah, I picked Kentucky pretty handily here with that very same thing, that the hangover effect. There's just no telling. I'm sure those coaches are trying to do the best job they can to get their heads out of the clouds. But, you know, like you said, Kentucky with the open date, Kentucky's got a very good defense. I think they can make things frustrating. They've kind of got a lengthy list already of who they've kind of started making things frustrating for. I mean, when you look at the Carson Beck was really flustered against Kentucky. And so, you know, it's one of those things that I just think Kentucky wins this game like 30-10.
I've got a feeling it's going to be another fun weekend. Auburn having and deserving an open date before they head to Missouri next week. It's been tough for the Tigers. They didn't expect to be 2-4 at this point, but they desperately need to get a win here in the month of October when they're on the road.
Yeah, it's I would not.
Nobody expected them to get the win last week. I actually thought they played a little better last week than they have been playing.
I'm telling you, last week I picked it 31-10, and it was what, 31-13?
Yeah.
I think when Auburn goes to Georgia, it's the most predictable game in the SEC. One of. I mean, it's been Groundhog Day. It's been the same game every single time. Auburn scores one touchdown. They might get a field goal. This time they got two field goals, but it is so hard to believe that 13 points is the most points Auburn scored in Sanford Stadium since 2009.
Yeah, that is sad. That really is. David, great stuff as always. We really enjoy spending a little bit of time with you. Let everybody know how they can keep up with everything that you're doing daily.
Yeah, timesfreepress.com for the articles, and WGOW is the radio station. We're on 2 to 5 Central each week. Weekday, I should say.
Heading anywhere this weekend?
Yeah, got the Gators and the Vols.
All right.
So I've been to Oklahoma and Arkansas in two of the past 3 weeks. So it's a weird schedule. Tennessee played two league games on the road. They're about to play four in a row at home. There's an open date in there. And then they play their final two in Athens and Nashville. So my big trips for the year are over.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, enjoy the weekend. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Okay, you guys have a wonderful weekend.
All right. David Pascal joining us from Chattanooga, as he does every Thursday. We'll get to our bottom of the hour break. Love for you to join in the final half hour here on the Thursday Drive.
Bill Cameron and Dan Peck on Auburn Opelika Sports Leader, ESPN 106.7.
Welcome back into the drive here on this Thursday. We've got about 25 minutes left. Love for you to join in. You can call us on the drive hotline, 334-321-1390, and that, of course, sponsored by Skybar.
You can also text the show, 334-564-1840 on the drive text box, presented by our friends at Southeastern Industrial Contractors.
All right, Justin Ferguson from the Auburn Observer here with us, as is usually the case on Thursdays. All right, Ferg. Want to get your mid-season report from Auburn. All right, we're halfway through the season. Auburn getting its first open date. I don't think anyone involved with Auburn is happy with a 2-4 record. But just your thoughts on where they are now, as compared to where you thought they'd be. Maybe not record-wise, but just playing where they are and. And where do they go from here to try to, you know, feel better about themselves at the end of the season?
Yeah, I mean, I think we learned in the first half of the season it wasn't just the turnovers that's holding Auburn's offense back. They are just not very efficient. They're not getting very many scoring opportunities in games, and they're not finishing those drives when they get those scoring opportunities. They can be explosive. It is a passing attack that can stretch the field more this year. Jarquez Hunter's off to a really good start this season. Auburn's just got to figure out ways on offense just to figure, like, how do they finish drives? How do they get it where it's not all or nothing, which is kind of what it's kind of felt like this year.
Yeah.
How do you get the points to line up with the yards per play numbers, right?
Yeah.
Like the yards per play and explosive play numbers that would indicate that this is an offense that should be scoring a lot of points, and it's an offense that hasn't scored as many points as one would expect in that situation.
And like I said a couple weeks ago, it's like, teams are fully capable of going through a year and not having the yards and the points line up. UCF was an example last year, Nebraska a few years ago. We've seen this a lot of times, and it's just that's how you have losing records. That's how you lose winnable games. You got to finish your drives. The game is about finishing your drive. So if you're Hugh Freeze and this staff, they have to – like the opportunities are there. They just have not really at any point this season – done a good job against quality competition of just finishing their opportunities. Like, even in the games where they lost closer, should have won, you can point to didn't finish here, didn't finish here, didn't finish here. So that's something they've got to be able to, you know, improve moving forward. I think defensively, Auburn is about where I thought they would be, at times a little better. I didn't think they played well against Georgia, but Georgia kind of had a lot to do with that as well. The amount of youth they're playing on that side of the ball, I think, is a good sign for the future. You're getting those guys experience. You got to live with some of the growing pains there. The second half of the season is really interesting for Auburn because you're 2-4. You need to win four of your last six to make a bowl game. It's not impossible. They have to play a lot better than they've played so far.
Right, and like I said with David a little while ago, I mean, I think they have to win one of these October games.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of these next two coming up. And I think if you look at it for Auburn, you can come into the second half of the season and say, look, the SEC is upside down this year. College football is upside down. This is a very 2007-esque kind of year where you feel like anything can happen. Things are taking on a life of its own. I think that's due to the fact the amount of roster changes that we're getting year in and year out. It is tougher to be consistently awesome, especially when you have some big-name coaches making moves, like obviously what happened in Alabama. For Auburn, though, like, Missouri is a really good team. They also just got flattened by Texas A&M. Kentucky is a very good team with a very good defense, especially up front. They also got blown out by a South Carolina team that has suffered their fair share of blowouts. Texas A&M has struggled on offense for most of the year. Obviously figured some things out last week. It'd be interesting if that sticks around, if that was a one-off. Vandy, is Vandy the team that beat Alabama or the one that lost to Georgia State?
Right.
You have ULM. you could put yourself in a position where you get to the Iron Bowl and like you still have a shot at having some real improvement this year. I think in many ways, I think Auburn football is a better team in 2024 than they were in 2023. However, in the most important aspects, they are not better than they were last year, and that's why the scoreboard reads what it does, and that's why the record reads what it does. They are more explosive on offense. They are more consistent, I think, with their running game. I think their defense has made some strides in some areas. It doesn't matter, though, because you're losing plenty of games. So, you know, it's a frustrating spot to be in if you're Auburn, because I think you are a better team, but you miss so many opportunities that you have no margin for error in the second half of the year. Good news, though, is I don't look at the second half of the season and I think it's impossible.
There's some winnable opportunities
there. Yeah, but they've got to play a lot better than they have played.
And I would also – I'm less concerned than I – you know, if you told me Auburn was 2-4 a couple of weeks ago, one of my concerns would be how is that playing with the first and second year players who probably thought that they would be winning more games than this at this stage? How is it playing on the recruiting trail with the guys that Hugh Freeze is trying to bring into the fold for next year? The sense I get is that, and this could look, if it implodes over the final six games, this could change. But the sense I get is that in part because Auburn is playing a lot of their first and second year players on both sides of the ball, there doesn't appear to be concern of a mass exodus after the season that sort of resets the progress Hugh Freeze has made
right
the first 2 years. I think if you were seeing a lot of juniors, like if juniors and seniors were all over the field for Auburn right now.
But if
the first and second year guys that Hugh Freeze had signed were waiting their turn to make an impact and that was the story at every position and Auburn was 2-4, I think you'd have concern about whether or not you're going to be able to keep those young guys. I mean, that's the story. That's more or less the Billy Napier story, is that, it, you know, and losing hurt, but also the idea that these guys were, you know, were still, you know, these guys that thought they could be part of the solution were behind other players on the depth chart was an issue too. I think it's a mix.
I wrote about it for tomorrow. I think Auburn's top four or five skill position players on offense and snaps this year are all seniors.
Mm-hmm.
Later on down, though, you do have more guys. I think defensively you're starting to funnel in some more of that. You got to figure out, you know, get Cam Coleman a little bit more consistently involved instead of just being this all-or-nothing, you know, shot-based offense with him. Malcolm Simmons, Perry Thompson, get those guys rolling a little
I wonder if it's a question of fewer plays and more efficiency from Cam. Like, I wonder if it's a matter of, like, getting more – because he's been playing a lot, right?
Yeah, he has been playing a lot. It's just his targets just feel like they're all or nothing. In the Oklahoma game, I thought after that first drop, they did a good job of giving him some easier stuff. You never felt like they got to that at all against Georgia.
One of the first things Freeze mentioned at the postgame press conference was that he thought – or no, maybe this was an answer to my question, you know, where he said Georgia really – said they were going to take Cam Coleman out of this game.
No. They did a good job of bracketing him, but like I think you can figure out ways to like make it work, especially if like I don't know. It's just I feel like Auburn could use that talent better. I feel like they could use a guy like Jeremiah Cobb better. Not a young guy, but like I think Jarquez Hunter needs more than 13 carries a game.
Doesn't everybody?
Yeah, like it's one of those things that when you look at it and just say, okay, I know Auburn is not going to be a team that, you know, becomes run heavy. That's just not what Hugh Freeze does. But even still, you are much more efficient as an offense right now when you're handing the ball off to 27 mm-hmm. than you are dropping back to pass. So the ratio can be better balanced. I'm not saying 50-50, and I'm not saying Jarquez Hunter needs to carry the ball 25 times a game. I just don't know if that's even viable there, but it should be more than 13.
One of the things that was a little surprising was yesterday when Jason said that, I hadn't thought about it, that Peyton threw 13 of his 27 passes in the fourth quarter.
Yes.
So that means that heading into the fourth quarter, Auburn had run 39 plays, and only 13 of them were passes.
Now, there are a lot of scrambles and sacks, too.
There were.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I think Jarquez finished that game with like 11 or 12 carries.
But it wasn't the one-sided pass attempts compared to runs up until then.
The box score obscures, the final box score obscures that until Auburn runs that fateful fourth and one play to start the fourth quarter, it had been more balanced than it had been against any other power conference team to that point this season. Like Auburn had been more run heavy,
and still Jarquez Hunter only gets a dozen touches.
And still,
so
yes,
like, yeah.
Well, that's the problem when you only get 39 snaps in the first three quarters. That's been a problem for Auburn consistently keeping the ball. Auburn, you said they've been more explosive, but they haven't been able to put together any long, you know, multi-play drives. They've had a few, but not many.
The other really, and I want the stat that Ferg's pulling up, but I would say the other really promising point on that front would be Auburn's down 11 first drive of the second half after getting that three and out. Kudos to the Auburn defense for getting that three and out stop to start the second half, because that game could have been over a lot earlier than it was. If Georgia starts the second half with a touchdown and it's 21-3 Auburn touches the ball again, it would start to feel like checkmate very early in Athens. Instead, Auburn gets the ball down 11, six straight runs, and Jarquez caps off that drive with a touchdown. So the idea that – and again, I forget how many of those were called runs. I think Peyton might have scrambled
– so it was at least one Peyton design run. It may have been a couple of scrambles.
Yeah, but still, I mean, the idea that Auburn came out of the second half, even trailing 11, and said we're gonna try to run the football to get back in this game, that's big.
All right, we need to get to a break. We'll be right back with more. You can join in as well, 334-321-1390 here on the Thursday Drive.
Since 1997, Riverside.
Toll free at 888-382-7502 or email us at thedrive@espnau.com.
Welcome back into the Drive here on this Thursday afternoon. We're heading up toward 6 o'clock. Do we have, let's see there, we've got the replay.
I think it's Tiger Talk.
We should have the replay of Tiger Talk.
And then baseball.
And then, Yankees Royals baseball. You were about to give us a stat that you were looking up there before we went to break.
Yeah, okay, so this is a stat called Echol rate. It is a relatively new concept, but basically what Echol does is an Echol possession for a team is if you get the ball inside the 40, if you snap the ball inside the 40 at any point on the drive.
The opponent's 40.
The opponent's 40. Okay. At any point on the drive, or you get a big play to score on, right? So you look at that. Those are your scoring opportunities in football, basically. If you're inside the 40, you should score more often than not. Auburn this season is 96th in the country at creating those opportunities. So the rate of their drives that either go inside the 40 or score a touchdown, they are 96th in the country. And then on top of that, they are 92nd in points per scoring opportunity. Mm-hmm. So not only are they not getting into that range regularly,
when they
they're
do,
not.
They're not.
You get credit by going from a possession that goes from outside.
If you take a snap inside the opponent's 40-yard line, and I think it might be first down inside the 40.
Or score a touchdown
from a big play.
I mean, Auburn went the whole game. I believe the Cal game, right? Auburn didn't take a snap in Cal territory after the touchdown. After the last time Auburn scored, Auburn went a long time before even getting into Cal
territory. I'll give you a perfect example. The Georgia game. Auburn had three scoring opportunities. They scored 13 points on those scoring opportunities, touchdown, two field goals. But they only had three out of 10 or 11 drives in the game.
Possessions.
Meanwhile, Georgia got in there six or seven times and score touchdowns on most of them. That's the thing. It's like, yes, turnovers affect that, all that stuff. But, like, Auburn has a problem just moving the ball and getting in.
Consistently.
They're not get like, you can say, oh, well, they're having a bad time finishing drives. That is true. They're 92nd in the country at finishing drives. They're also not creating those scoring opportunities effectively enough. And that's the thing. It's like, it's kind of like with the quarterback situation after the Cal game. It is more than just the quarterback, and for Auburn, it is more than just the turnovers.
Quickly plug the Observer website before we take a commercial break.
Yeah, auburnobserver.com, $6 a month, $60 a year. Big day tomorrow. We've got huge mailbag, football and basketball in there, and then Dan and I are about to record our annual basketball-only podcast. It was kind of our bi-week tradition where we're going to run through the entire Auburn rotation. I think we're going to do player by player and kind of give our thoughts about them heading into the season. So auburnobserver.com, sign up there.
All right, we will get to our final break of the afternoon. Stick with us here on the Thursday Drive. Experience.